Okay. Usually they say that our decisions or events in our lives, right, do have our actions, you know, do have consequences, you know, things of that nature. So that's why I asked that first question, that when you look back the last 6 decades of your life, right, what will you consider events, right, that are unique and that are consequential, you know, to you?
Straight off, between 1961 and 70, I think what, apart from being born and starting primary school, I think what would be the most significant event in my life that I recall is having to run away from school or having to be evacuated from school because there was a war. Yeah, I remember that very, very, you know how it is with school. School is so regular and constant. Nothing disrupts it. If instead there are days of maybe independence or harvest or stuff like that. So those are regular. But I remember that suddenly we all had to leave school and our parents, you know, suddenly showed up, or those whose parents didn't show up, the headmaster came and just, I knew we had to evacuate school, and we ran home. And when you close before time, it was more joy. I mean, we didn't know what impending doom was coming. That was to disrupt our lives for a little bit. But significantly, Jamin, what that did for me was that we had to go to the village, you know, back and forth. But significantly, what that did for me was that it made me learn my language. It brought me closer to my language. The Yoruba I speak today, the music I love today, the dance I love today, all of that was built in that period that I had to be home with my grandparents and had to be in the village. It was a very significant thing, and it has affected me all my life. So for me, the Civil War brought me closer to my culture, my tradition. Okay. So I pick that as the highlight, you know, of that era for me.
Okay. And the second decade?
From 70 to 80, well, that was secondary school and my HSC. It's significant in the sense that by the end of the 70s, I had found myself as a young man. I was 19. I had found my rhythm. I had started to understand my body. I was very athletic. I wrapped up that decade in St. Patrick's College at Saba.
Okay.
Where I became the Victor Ludorum, the best sportsman. I became the games prefect. I was head of dramatic society. I was a renowned actor, even at that stage in my life, because something happened when I got to St. Patrick's College at Saba. I recall that there was a play that was about to be performed. They usually had a performance between, if they wanted girls to be, women to be in their plays, or girls to be in their plays, would take from a school, a female school. I remember that there was already a play that was being done. I didn't have a major role in it. And suddenly the guy who was supposed to play the major role, I think his father died or something, and he had to go home. And the play was about to be canceled, and I stepped up and I said, I can do it, you know? And of course I did it. And that was the birth of another side of me in that locality of, oh, he's not just good with games, he's also, you know, an actor. And so you can say that it was the prepping of me for what was to come at the University of Benin, you know. So the 70s for me was to the 80s, that was finding me, finding a rhythm, academic rhythm, social rhythm. I knew that, you know, there was something I had. I did a lot of sporting events and everything, and so I saw what audience adulation can do to you, either in the field of sports, or when you are debating, or when you are acting. And so I started to understand the power of an audience. That I have held until date. I've always held that. I preach that a lot when I teach acting or do workshops for actors or for public speakers. I always say that it is so important that the audience can see your soul. And the day a performer, a speaker, a coach, anybody who deals with the public, the day you understand that the audience can see your soul, your performance changes. Your responsibility towards the audience changes. And I started to notice that earlier on from my being a sports person or an actor or a debater in school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So then from the 80s, of course, I got into UniBen in 1980. And like I said, having found myself academically and all that, I didn't ditter or titter anymore. I could tell where my strengths were, and so I pursued it vigorously. Of course, you know, one had all the challenges, of course, of distractions and all that, but I held on, and I didn't make a first class, but I graduated as one of the best students in my class. I made a 2-1, and which again prepped me for what was again to come. Incidentally, it was important that one had a very strong discipline in the theater, because theater was like boot camp for life. Because when I went for youth service, I served in Bauchi. That was also very significant for me because I wanted to experience life outside of the South. I felt that I didn't know anything about the North. And so when people were, unlike today, when people look for how to stay closer to home because of all these challenges, we wanted to go out, we wanted to explore. And so I was posted to Bauchi State, and it was one of the best things for me that happened to me post-graduation, because then I was able to experience the North, the culture, and all of that. And indeed, I when I was serving, I represented Bauchi State at the Festival of Arts and Culture in Maiduguri. You know, I went not as a contingent from Delta State or from Bendel or from Lagos, but from Bauchi State, which was very significant for me. So that was what it was. Remember that Buhari took over in, I think it was 83, late 83 or 84. And so here we were, as youth coppers, you know, experiencing another coup after some stability with the civilians. Of course, there was all the plenty talk of corruption, Joseph Wires and co. You know, they had done their thing, you know, and so that came. And of course, we all welcomed them at the time. Nobody saw how draconian whatever that was going to be. And I would revisit this. I mentioned this because it's important. Don't forget, in the 60s, civil war, you know, and then in the 80s, smack in the very early stages, the struck, and there was more or less the what they call an embargo on employment, so to speak. I think they were claiming what they considered an urgent stable, and then we were. Youth service over, and there's no job. You know, we had heard stories that all you needed to do was have a good degree, a 2-1 in your hand, enthusiasm, ready to work, ready to take on the world, and you can't take on the world. Things had gotten to a point where there was no discernible area to put yourself. And so I came in, I started becoming very angry as a young graduate, And so that, again, was a turning point in my life, because all I thought I needed to do was have a degree, a good degree, and come out and I'll have a job. And so I come to Lagos in 1984, fresh out of school, fresh out of youth service, enthusiastic, had ideas of what in Nigeria could be and all that. And then here I am, there's a coup, there's a new regime, and they claim they're doing what was better for us, but here I was, a young school leaver, no job. And that was how my struggle started. It fired my poetry. I got into, channeled my anger into poetry, into performance poetry. So most of my early poems were very upset. I was a very upset young man. I was very upset with the system and all that. So I did performances that were very strong, and they were very vocal, you know, against bad governance and all of that. Towards the end of it all, you know, before the end of it, you know, like everybody, you know, that was the era of the brain drain. And I attempted it. I attempted the brain drain. I went to England for a while, to London for a while, worked, you know. And I also found out that if, when I looked at where I was, I didn't want to be an illegal alien. And when I also looked at London or England at the time, looking for black people who were, who I could look up to and see what, whether or not if I did right, you know, I couldn't see it. Comedians were the ones that were thriving. People like Lenny Henry and Co were the ones that were thriving. And I didn't see myself in that space. And so painfully, I had to come back. Or fortunately, I had to come back to Nigeria. And I came back and I was able to join, that was now the period where the soap operas were really opening up. And fortunately for me, I had done one called Legacy before I left, but then now was the era of Ripples, you know, and then I joined Ripples, you know, and started establishing myself. I had started establishing myself on stage, but television was always the thing. And I was able to join Ripples, and that gave me some fame. So by the time the new decade came, and don't forget, so I rounded the that decade with getting married, you know, to my late wife, me. We got married in 89, you know, just at the very edge of it. And so by the 90s was not the 90s started for me trying to be a husband, father. Part of the things that happened to me also in the 80s, just because that was significant. I had kids. I had my two boys in the 80s.
Okay.
Now that was, yeah, I think I should mention that about the 80s. That was very significant because as I was leaving school, university, graduating, the joke for me then was that I just didn't graduate with a 2-1. I graduated with having two boys to deal with, you know. And that sort of also made me angrier. I felt that I had entered my future with a lot of luggage, and I needed to, you know, so not having to find a job on time and all of that was part of what was firing, you know, my anger. So got married at the end of it, and then started the 90s finding love and trying to now live a new life of responsibility, you know, of building a home and all of that. And fast forward for me, the 90s, the highlights will be, I don't want to call it the harvest of death, but that's what it was in practical terms, because I lost my wife, like, you know, in 1996, and before then I had lost my dad in 91. In between that as well, I lost two of my younger brothers, and then my mom, My mom passed in 99. And so that was such a, between 1991, you know, and 99, it was such a, my life was so compressed and so eventful. I built a business from Classic. I left and I started Mr. Magazine. When I sold Mr. Magazine, I mean, look at all those beautiful highlights of having to start your own business and sell it, you know, long before people became fancy. It became fanciful that you start a business and you sell and you exit at some point. I did all of that in the 90s, but there I was also now dealing with debt. The most significant, of course, being my wife and my mom, the two most important women in my life, losing them. It was a tough period, and that was also what led me to, in a sense, led me to start studying law, because I kept looking for avenues to throw myself into to just distract myself from having to deal with my loss. And it was in the process that I started law so that I could just focus on something that was difficult, you know. And I'm glad that I did that. Because by when the 2000 came, I was more or less like ready. I'd had 4 years to mourn and all that. And then, so the 2000, from 2000 to 2010, was finding love again and getting married. I got married from the very beginning of the millennium, like they call it, whatever they call it. And it was again a rebirth for me, because then I had two kids in the process with my present wife. And my law study blossomed. And of course I graduated from UNILAG, went to law school, got called to the bar in 2005. Also in that period, you know, before the end of 2010, I've gotten the call to serve in my state.
Okay, yeah.
You know, in Delta State, of course I went to Delta State. So the significant thing about this is about going back to Delta State again was what happened to me in the 60s. It was like a reflection of that, just that this time it was different. It got me closer to my people again, and this time not just to learn or to appreciate the culture and the tradition, but to see the difficulties of living in the rural areas or living in the villages where politics behaves like a visitor, a seasonal visitor. Politics is seasonal in the sense that it is only when elections are near that politicians come home to try and do some cosmetic things and run off again and wait for another 4 years for the cycle to come in. And what I met at home was a yearning gap to help, you know. In a sense, when you get into politics, most of the people, the good ones who go into politics, is what you find is the depths of need of your people, and you want to just jump in there and be able to solve the problems. In a sense, I did what I could. I am happy to report that I met a young man who was the president of my community, who more or less tutored me on what to do. And when people were looking for cheap fame to get their people to support them, I knew I wasn't interested in being an elected official, but I knew that I could contribute significantly to my community. So what I did was, the guy advised me, I bought a boat, I bought two engine boats, built two boats, and gave to my community. And those boats are still working and providing revenue for the community till today. But motorcycles for some people and all that. And even though I don't do it every year anymore, but from time to time, my wife and I will still go back home and distribute food and money to women and children. So that was it, getting into politics, understanding it, getting closer to my people, and knowing what their needs are, getting involved in the local politics of my place, not just at the state level, but at the community level. I'm still involved now at the community level, because it's important to mentor as many people as possible so that people who come in to serve understand that it is to serve and not for personal enrichment. By the time 2010 was over, we were getting into the new one. I had also started to understand, you know, the significance of my political position, and knowing that once you get in, you don't get out. Even if you don't run for elective office, you don't leave your community. You start to engage in the community in different capacities, and that is what I'm doing now. You know, making sure that nothing happens there without at least having an ear to the ground, and making sure that you contribute your own quota. And so for the 2020, from 2010 to 2020, I found that politics was not for me. I wasn't going to get engaged in elective politics. And when 2015 came, and I had served for 8 years, two terms with my former governor. As he left, I left. And then came back to my first love, which is the creative or the entertainment industry, which I'm very glad that I did, because I found my rhythm again. It was between 2010 and 2020 was a chance to start to rebrand myself, to reinvent myself, if you like. And in a sense, I think I did that successfully, because people use me as an example today. I came back into the acting industry, and today I've claimed my place. People say to me, I attend seminars where I speak on relevance, on being relevant over a decade, over a long period of time, because 37 years post-graduation later, I'm still smack in the middle of my profession, talking about it passionately, like I never left at any point, like I've been in it all my life. Yes, in a sense, when I did leave, I didn't leave. I just left the performance stage, so to speak. I went to perform on another stages. And what are the odds? I was in culture and tourism anyway, so yeah. I never really left. That's fair. But to come back as an actor and be number one again, says to me that those things that I told you I learned from Asaba, finding that there is a nexus between performance and audience reaction, finding that the minutes as a performer of any kind, and I passed, like I said, like if you have to ever encounter an audience, once you can be truthful, once you can, they can see your truth, they will connect. And that is what has worked for me. And we have multiple platforms now. There's the rebirth of cinemas is here. We're riding with it. COVID, the new normal came, and streaming is now the everything, and we are riding it. It's a thing of joy to be able to be in people's homes all over the world and have movies that can trend for a while in different countries across the world, and anybody can see you from Nigeria to Iceland, anybody, anywhere. These days you get into a border country and all they need to do is push a button and your name pops up, and they can verify either through your Instagram account or your Twitter or whatever. So yeah, I've managed to do the transition from being a dinosaur to a digital one, you know, and one has managed not to be consumed by the advancement in technology and all that. Instead, one is learning to adapt to use tech as it changes the world, to also change one's self. And as I prepare to be 60 in this new decade, which is very significant, you know, in 2001, I'm looking forward to even engaging the decade and engaging with the technology and the science of it as much as I can, without looking at myself as being too old to engage in it, because if you don't adapt, you die.
Yeah. In 3 years' time, it'll be 40 years on, you know, 30, is it? 40 years of post-performance.
Yes.
So probably we're going to come back and discuss from that point where you just rested.
Yes. Yes.
Now, quick question. I want to go back to some things you said earlier. Yes. In the 60s, you know, you saw the war, right? And through the eyes of a kid.
Yes.
Okay? And of course, it probably influenced you in certain ways.
Yes.
Now, in the 60s, I mean, when I say in the 60s, in terms of your age, yeah, people are calling for war in Nigeria.
Oh, yeah.
Looking at it through the eyes of an adult now, based on what you learned as a kid, what do you have to say?
There's nothing in this world that will make me even advocate for war. One of the beauties of today's life is that once leadership can see what the situation is, everybody should come to the round table. You know, I mean, look at the splintering of Russia and the coming back together of Germany. These are life lessons for us. I mean, what are you running away from? You know, when there is a clamor for something, you don't... It's like what somebody said. He simplified it so much. I said, if you are the leader, if you are the head of a family and your children are fighting and clamoring for something, you don't run away. You call them and say, you know, so how do we do it? You know, if there are not enough rooms in this house, you know, should we, and there is some land outside, should we clear and you guys move to the right, you know. There are practical and workable solutions for this country that we don't have to wait and get to the point where it conflagrates. And then it becomes really ugly, because the face of war is very ugly. Now that you mentioned it, let me simplify it by illustrating with another thing that happened that has been etched in my memory for the longest time. And I think that speaks to the point. Talking about the devastation of war, in my head, I saw Hausa women lined up, being paraded. I'm getting emotional. We were told at some point that some of them were killed, that some of those lines that you saw were taken to be killed. In my mind's eye, I saw men being paraded. Again, they will tell you, these ones are going to be taken to be killed. I learned to spell Urobo during the war as a kid. U-R-O-H-O-B-O. U-R-O-H-O-B-O. Why, German? It had to be printed or written with a chalk or charcoal on buildings. It was like the Passover was coming, and if you had that blood stain, God will pass you by and not destroy you. If you were a robo, or the property was a robo, they wouldn't touch it. So, people, worry had Igbos, and a lot of people, most of them were family friends and all of that. Yokodilis and all those things, their houses were either taken or destroyed, depending on who was passing through Warri or Midwest at the time. You know, either when it was the Igbo's turn to pass through or to take over or the federal. Now, here is the most significant of it all. There was a Hausa man called, that we all called Momo T. He used to sell tea. Oh, tea. Tall. I remember him. I can smell him as I'm speaking now. Had a big nose. It was my grandmother used to buy grains, beans, rice, and all that from the north. And Momo was our friend. He sold tea. He sold rice. He even sold beads. You know, they had the way of selling very odd things. And when that war came, I recall suddenly seeing Momo tea in my father's living room. We hid him. My grandmother, when things came to a head, Momo ran to our house. Or maybe it was my grandmother that brought Momo. And so when it was supposedly evacuated, we were all in the village. My father used to work in MPA. Momo was in my house, in our house. My father would get home first, think maybe take care of him, before crossing over to Elijah. Momo stayed, I don't know, I can't remember how long. That is the face of war in my head. So, where would I go? What sides, you know, who will be a refugee this time around? Who will be hunted and by who? I mean, if our memories fail us about what the Civil War was like, what about Rwanda? You know, how can we even begin to play with it? It is something that should terrify us every day. The face of war is too ugly. For me, dialogue is the thing. And there are practical steps. There are living examples. You know, the regions can survive on their own. This is no longer the 60s or the 50s when the colonial masters didn't have all the answers. We're not looking at it. They were looking at it through different prisons. But the reality on the ground now is that there's enough technology. We have all our things that we can deal with in the region, and the interference from the center must be reduced, so that people can go back and thrive within their regions, and let it be a question of choice, you know, for people to stay within their regions or whatever and find the prosperity that they're looking for, or the economic or the political freedom or whatever that they're looking for.
So in other words, you're in support of the call for, is it like a conference again?
Oh, the call for a restructuring.
Yeah, restructuring conference.
Yes, in whatever, be it fiscal or physical, you know, yes, there must be a revisit. If the fundamentals that hold us together as a people tends to divide us more now, then there's something wrong with the union. You know, the state of the union is not good. It's not well. We have to, there is no way. We have to be able to look at ourselves in the face and be able to come to the table. I mean, people had written over and over how did the killing of Sarawa help what the agitation in the Ogoniland? How does ignoring the IPOB guy, Nnamdi Kanu, how does it strengthen us as a country? You don't ignore, you don't pretend, you don't play ostrich. It's a white elephant in the room. Deal with it. It's a bull in the China shop. Deal with it. Don't pretend like it's not there. You know? How do you not acknowledge the Midwestern cry now? Why do you think that you need to wait forever until it becomes an aggressive, you know, pursuit before you start to do? How do you ignore the Oduduwa cry? You can't do that. You must listen to everybody, and that can only happen if there is, you know, well orchestrated dialogue.
Okay. When you were speaking earlier on, you said something about, you know, the NYSE experience, right?
Yes.
You said that it represents something significant, you know, for you.
Yes.
Okay. Trying to tie to what we just discussed about the need. I mean, you said if the fundamentals that hold us together probably have fallen apart,
yes,
maybe the various regions should go their different ways. is a united Nigeria? I mean, based on your experience, when you said you went to Bauchi, you didn't even represent Delta, Lagos, or some other places, you represented Bauchi at your festival. Question, the fundamentals that held us together as Nigeria, you know, are there, I mean, what are the things that challenge those elements that have now made it possible or imperative for folks to be calling for a separation?
It's leadership. It's leadership that doesn't have, there is no visionary leadership. I mean, look, what happened with the war? There was a shout for reconciliation, right? Why did a young boy from Midwest or Bengal State at 21 years, at 22 years, sorry, what was making him clamor to go and experience life in the North? It was the oneness in my head. I am a Nigerian, but I haven't been to the North to experience the North. Let me go there. It's my country. You know, and the leadership then worked it out. The leaders at that time could meet together and work it. As mundane as the rotational system between of the PDP might be or whatever, it's a rallying call for peace, for togetherness. What has happened is, you know, leadership, it's like what happened even here in America. One leader comes and the divisive elements are played up as opposed to being played down. And so what has happened in Nigeria with Buhari is that we have never been more divided. I mean, don't forget that the conflagration of Nigeria was predicted during the Jonathan regime. But even at that time, it wasn't this bad. Now, there is a tendency to play up all the elements that divide us instead of the ones that, you know, bring united. Us together. Of course, a united Nigeria will always be better. If power devolves to the regions, you know, and there is no undue advantage being taken by the center. Because what is happening now is that the center constantly takes advantage of the regions without due recourse to the needs of the regions. How do you explain that the major resource of Nigeria being oil today is controlled 99% by the North, where there is not a drop, at least explorable drop of oil right now. And the natural resources that are there are constantly being told that they are illegally mined. And once there is the illegal bunkerings that started here, it's like a reprisal. It's like a retaliation. Like, okay, you know what? Since you guys have some natural resources out there, but you constantly say you cannot bring them to the national purse because illegal miners are taking advantage of it, then we that own the resources here, we want to illegally mine, or we want to also own our resource and mine it ourselves and sell it for ourselves, even though it has ended up degrading our environment in very terrible ways. But you see, so that's what the thing is. So when me, a southerner, for instance, if I'm interested in oil and gas and I need to have access to it, then I have to go through a northerner that is in charge, I will begin to question the balance. How? Why? You know, why can't I? I mean, will I be able to go to the North and to Zamfara, for instance, and own the rights to mining the gold there? So these are legitimate questions that people are asking. And when people are beginning to ask, when people begin to ask questions like that, you must pause and begin to look at why these questions are coming up. then there is a disequilibrium in how people feel that they are being treated. There's no equity, there's no justice. And once there is a feeling of that, then you have to address it. Anything that is repugnant, you know.
Yeah, you said earlier on that one of the problems, you know, that beset Nigeria at the moment is that bad leadership.
At every level.
And now, you're also suggesting that it seems the leaders are not listening to what is going on or what the people are saying. Is that the case?
Yes, they are not listening, and they are not visionary enough. They can't see beyond, you know, party politics, beyond enshrining their political parties in power, beyond enriching themselves or enriching their folks. They cannot see beyond all of that. I mean, how do you not see what is happening in a small country like Rwanda? That is selfless leadership. Today, when you talk about Kagame, you don't talk about private jets. You don't talk about yachts and properties that he owns. The man keeps engaging. He stands in conferences, looks at African leaders in the face and say, you guys must be mad. You guys are not even thinking. You know, I'm here as your fellow African president. You have a need. You run past me. You go to France to ask for something that I can provide for you. What are you going to do in France? What are you going to do in London? You know, there are things that we can do for ourselves here. Why can't the president of Nigeria be talking to the president of Togo or Benin and have, you know, clear border relations and all that? Why should there be restrictions, you know, between us? Why can't our border be like that of Mexico and America? You know, I mean, Africa, Nigeria is like, we are the giants, right? There's nothing that, there's this professor I love, I've forgotten the name, the Kenyan professor, that says that the day Nigeria wakes up, the day that giant wakes up and recognizes its strength, and finally visionary leadership is at the top of it, that we will take over the entire world, not just Africa. And that's the truth, because what is it that we don't have? I think he says that we are some of the most brilliant people in the world, and we have proven that in every sphere, from the sciences to the arts. There are leading scientists in NASA and all of that are Nigerians, that people have long forgotten that are Nigerians. In the tech world, there are Nigerians that are making waves. In every sphere, in medical field, right smack in this new vaccine era, there are Nigerians that are smack in the middle of the creation of some of these vaccines. So what is it that we don't have? It is leadership that does not see through the prism of tribalism and nepotism and all the isms that holds us back.
So in spite of the flaws of the leaders, I mean, those, because when you look at the Nigerian story from 1960 to now, we've been recycling leaders, poor leaders, I mean, leaders with poor skills in terms of running the country. Question, why is that in spite of this, Nigerians, when it comes to election day, we still go to the polling booths and still vote for these bad leaders?
Because of the poverty, because there are two things that happen during elections. Remember what I said to you, what I noticed back home in the village. It's a cycle. It's like a harvesting cycle. Because there's no call to arms, and I don't mean that literally.
Yeah.
And remember I said it is poor leadership at every level. So it's not just at the top, even at the, there is no strong organization. I'll give you an example of what good leadership can do. When I went home and I spoke to my people, you know, and I started to organize them, we started to vote as a block. So if you can't do something significant for Alagia, we won't give you our vote. At least the majority of those who hear of the voting people who hear our voice will not vote for you. That is what needs to be done. That is why politics must start at the local level. Once you have strong leadership at every level, then you will be rejected. That was why Abiola's election is considered today as the most credible, because the electorate still has some education. And once a good, don't forget that for elections, it is always a question of the system that the country is running. So it's a question of what you are presented with. So it's always the lesser of two evils or three or five evils, right? So whatever it is that you're presented with is what you do. So most of these times when, unfortunately, when these elections are run, come up now, the manipulation of the electoral process constantly de-enfranchises the voter, because even though their votes count, the electoral rigging process sometimes discounts it. Votes can be manufactured depending on whoever is paying the price. Votes can be manufactured, they can be burnt, they can do anything and just write figures and say this is what the figures that are, and they will look for things, evidence to support whatever figures that they are writing. So when people say that the votes don't count, it is understandable. So to answer your question, it's not every time that you think that they go to this, that they vote for this leadership, that they truly vote for this leadership. I mean, people will tell you that Buhari didn't win this last election. You know, so it becomes a question of, but it is what INEC says happened that happened. You know, so we thank God for tech. Hopefully, with tech, in another 10 years, election malpractices and all that will be further reduced to significant number. The day we can do it to a one-digit thing, then we are on our way to redemption.
Yeah. You said something about, you know, when you were speaking about Alaja, that now you guys organize,
yes,
and you determine, hey, this is the place we're going to be,
yes,
voting for.
Yeah.
Does that suggest that the time has come for Nigeria to have community organizers that will not engage with the community directly and help shape or influence the outcome? Because if ultimately nationwide we have community organizers who have helped in galvanizing their communities to elect specific, you know, persons, could that help us to checkmate?
It does. There are community organizers now, just that right now some of them are agents of this
party.
You know, so where there is a true commitment to, sorry, let me just find out. Hello? For whom? No, you have the wrong number. Sorry, where were
you? Yeah, I passed it before. Huh? Yeah, you were talking about, you said that we have some community organizers, but
yeah,
they are agents.
Agents of the politicians. So when we find communities that can identify, what do we do in Alaga? We're like, okay, so what are our interests? This is what our interest is. We want to see development. We want to see this. Once we have agreed and we look at it, we bring them to the town hall. They must come and make the commitment there. And we then decide who is the most genuine, you know, of them. And then we go and say, we'll vote for this person. And significantly, it has been happening the last, you know, how many years that I got there. And I think that they will do that. Any community will follow their organizers or their leaders once they can notice that, you know, the leader is not being selfish. One of the reasons I succeeded in Alaga, because if I do like this, if I open my hands, you guys know me, I don't have anything that I'm looking for here to gain. I'm not running for elective office. I'm just saying, anybody we vote for in this village, let the person be able to turn around, come in here and help us with our needs. And I am saying that I believe that this person will do it. Hold him responsible. If he doesn't do it, he doesn't enter this community again next time to open his mouth to say anything. We wait for him the next time he does. You know, that's what it is. Sometimes the communities have all these people. But again, once there is any form of complicitness in them, once the organizers are complicit, it scatters all over, and then they have to rebuild again. Because trust, to build trust takes a while. And you will find that in most communities now, because you just say, yeah, this one is, they've paid him, he doesn't even when they pay him, he doesn't come back here to give anybody anything. Once there is the absence of trust, that's it. So most of the community builders that are community organizers are just bad agents, you know. But yes, we do need people that can conscientize their communities, gather them, let them know what their needs are, and be able to have a common front to deal.
Yeah. Earlier he said something about the fact that when it comes to election day, right? Of course, it is known. Sometimes people vote, but the outcome may not be what the people voted
That's
for.
Right.
That brings me to the place of, the issue of money in politics. Mm. Like in Nigeria, it appears a lot of money is what determines the outcome. And now, not even legitimately, illegally, right? What can Nigeria do to de-emphasize the place of money in politics?
Again, like I said, tech is evolving, right? As tech is evolving, people will have access to information quicker. People will have access to be able to see whatever it is anybody's proposing or asking for. And with that, when the criteria for picking leaders becomes service, then money will be, money in politics will start to reduce. The reason why money is so significant now is that even getting around the electioneering process is very tedious. So the politicians will tell, and I can tell you for a fact too, that the electioneering process is so capital intensive, because you have to go around the entire local government, for instance. Let me take a local government. Or you go around the entire state. It takes man and resources to do that. But with tech, with improved security, with improved transportation and everything, it becomes easier. That's why I'm saying that. Ultimately, Africa and its leaders, they keep the economy, or they keep the infrastructure and all that the way they are to promote corruption. If you go to a ministry today and say, oh, let's digitize, they'll tell you no. You know, until very recently, how do you go to a ministry to get something and they'll say, oh, all monies will be paid through some window? How do you go to a window and you pay cash? Anybody that collects cash, it is open to corruption. Jamming people in churches steal monies. There are stories from all over the world with churches where people who are held in the highest esteem, spiritual, they steal money from the altar. Collections. I heard of a story of a couple with their son or their daughter or so, who will do their own collection bags at Redeem, and they will collect money and just go to their cars and load it and drive off. Replica of the church.
Churches.
Yeah. They caught them with bootloads of money. That is what happens in most ministries. Until you know, modern day, we're like, no, you go and pay in the bank. The improvement of IGRA in Lagos State and all these other states that are improving their IGRA is because of all this rejigging of reducing corruption. You know, once you stop collecting all these things, doing them manually, and you are deployed tech, a lot of these things will change. Once the dissemination of information and all that is faster, you don't have to go to some places. You can do most of your things cyberly or through. See what COVID did to us. We all had to do things through. Whoever thought that you could run a multi-billionaire company by everybody sitting at home in their pajamas and sitting on a Zoom, and, you know, without having to buy an expensive suit and go to the office every morning, rush buy coffee on the road. I mean, life changed in one year. You know, it will take some time. So I believe that the priorities are going to change with social infrastructures changing and all of that, and the call for service changing and all of that. The money that will be involved in politics will begin to reduce. Because if I, as a voter, I don't have need for your rice, I'm gainfully employed, I won't need your rice to vote for you. But if everybody is impoverished and kept impoverished, when that cycle of harvest comes, they'll say, I beg, let me eat the one that they are giving me now. I know it will take another time for them to come, but at least if I gather enough now, I will spread it, you know, to last me till, and who knows, once in a while, it will come by and give me something. So that's what it is, Jamie. The people are so impoverished that they have no voice. And so whatever you dish out to them, they will take graciously and even thank you for it without knowing that it is their patrimony that you are stealing.
Yeah. Good. You said something about, earlier on when you were saying something, when you responded to the question, you said something about, I'm a Nigerian, right? I mean, that was what was important to you at the point when, you know, today, most times when I read things online, I see people, oh, this Hausa man got A1, or what I say A1, maybe first class. Oh, this Igbo girl got first class. Oh, this Yoruba man got first class. In other words, when I look at what people say, ethnicity, right?
Yes.
People quickly...
Sorry, Jeremy, I have to take this call. Hello, Omaka. What should I send to you? What should I send to you now? No, I prefer them to come to through Fort Lauderdale. Okay. Yeah, I'm in the meeting. If you don't get response on time, just flash me. Yes.
Sorry, I will try to wrap up soon. Yeah, let's go back. Yeah, so ethnicity, I see that today most Nigerians identify more with their ethnicity more than the concept of being a Nigerian. Is there a solution? Because I see that as a fundamental problem too.
It's the divisiveness. Black Lives Matter. Why? Because suddenly there's a man at the helm of affairs who endangers black lives. So a man can kneel on the neck of a black person in public, and the person dies, and there still need to be an inquiry. You know, it's there, it's open. So it got to a point where people had to scream, our lives matter, black lives matter. And the pushback of all lives matter is again that divisiveness. Like I said, the conflagration of Nigeria was predicted during the Jonathan regime. Jonathan was not this divisive. When Buhari came, he became very divisive. And that is what has fired the individualism now, or the regional cries, or the I'm a Middle Easterner, or I'm a Bendelite, or I'm an Igbo man. That's what has fired it. This same country, where I said I wanted to go to the north, and it was just not about me. This same country that gave birth to the National Youth Service Corps. What was the foundation of it? Don't forget, it was part of the reconciliation process. Why? How did it work? It shows that when people constantly are bound together, when the cries are about unity, people will find the common ground. Right now, we are not finding common grounds because we are the elements that divide us is what is being played up. Oh no, you must be Fulani to make money. Oh no, you must be Islam to make money. You are a Muslim to make money. Oh no, if you are not a Christian, you can't come in here. Oh, if you are not an evangelical, you cannot be in that place. That is what happens when people begin to trump up, you know, certain sections, and then people will find their own cries, and then the cries now have become ethnic cries. You know, if a visionary leadership comes now who Nigerians see as very detribalized, trust me, it won't take more than 4 years before all of that changes again. So, you know, leadership is very significant because it's the head. And once you can identify the head, again, Jamie, let me draw an analogy for you that I already see. Leadership.
Hey, how are you?
Adios.
Peekaboo.
Come to carry you soon, sir.
How long? How soon?
Maybe 1 hour.
Okay. Well, you guys had said 12 before now.
Yeah, we'll see
you. You guys had said 12, I've been warned.
11.
No, 12.
To you?
Yeah. Well, if I... AY had said 1 p.m. to me yesterday.
Didn't tell me.
So I will park.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I've booked the place.
The place, what's it called?
Hilton, Homes by Hilton, for both of them. Okay. So maybe when you see it, you tell me that to also make that reservation for your...
No, you have to. Not maybe. make the reservation for my kids for tomorrow, yeah. Because
okay.
Sorted their ticket.
Okay. So I'm going to Christmas Palace with the props person, want to buy some more items, yes. Then I'll come back and take the bus.
Okay.
Yeah, so you're saying if you have a leader who...
Yes, so remember that thing I said about the audience. A political leader is like an actor on a stage. The rest of the country, the rest of us, we look at him. We can see his soul. No matter what veneer or facade he puts up, we see through it. That is why when leadership is wrong, the people can sense it. And no matter what he drops out through the media and all that, people will still say, no, you are lying. Behind all of this, this is who you really are. That is what it is. You know what I mean? Every member of the audience, or most members of the audience who are discerning, can see it. And so you can, that's why Bobali was saying you can fool some people sometimes, but you can't fool people all the time. The world is indeed a stage. We are watching you play your part. And we can see you for who you are. If you are lying, if you are not being true to us, we see you. So, no matter what your media handlers are seeing or spinning, they're just looking at you. When the time comes to kick you out, they'll kick you out. They will boo you. So I guess in a sense, so that's that analogy. When they boo you is when they reject you at the next election. you know? Like, woo, it was not sweet, go. Let another actor come. That's what it is. If leaderships do not understand that every time that you stand in front of more than one person to be accredited or to be applauded or to be acknowledged, they can see through you. Get it now. That is what people don't get. I always say, you know, it's funny that I became a life coach as well. I coach, I teach church, you know. And I say that I see life first and foremost as an actor. I say it is so significant that Shakespeare saw it long ago and he said the world is a stage and we all are actors. Everything, Yami, is about selling. The man who owns a factory and takes his time to fashion out a product called an iPhone or whatever is an actor. Because after all of that, he puts the iPhone and puts it in front of an audience and say, buy it, because this is a wonderful actor. He can make you sing, he can make you dance through. That's what it is. So when I break it down from every time, I said, there's nothing in this world you do. Insurance, banking, everything's all acting. It is all an audience. Either the audience, sometimes the performer is far from the audience. The further away you are, the more chasm that there is between the stage and the audience. The longer you have to travel before the audience will see you, the less attention you will get. But when you are right in it, when you are part of the audience, when they can see you and feel you and touch you, there's more resonance, there's more acceptance. And then the people thrive. The country thrives. The product thrives. Whatever it is that you are cooking or selling thrives. What is Buhari selling? He's selling nepotism. He said, and so it is not appealing. It's repugnant to a larger majority of people. What did Trump sell finally? Lies. Untruths, half truths. The man he that took vaccine. You know? And he was telling some people different things. You know, his followers, you know. So that's what it is for me.
Talking about actors, mm-hmm. So, I mean, we are all actors perform on the stage until the curtain drops, you know, or curtain call. How do you choose your role as an actor or your roles?
I look for the redemption. A journey is not complete until there is some kind of catharsis. The actor, the character must have some cathartic end or some redemptive end, because if it must be a complete experience. There's nobody that is good, you know, totally. There must be some curve. Life must throw you a curveball. And so when life throws you that curveball, what did you do? What do you do? When you fail, how did you get up? You know? Uh-huh. So that's, for me, that's what I look for, the redemptive value for the character. What is that thing that the audience can see and say, oh, if I ever am faced with this situation, I'm going to remember this. Yeah. That is what makes great, great characters. That's why you remember great characters. It's either their flaws and how they deal with it, or their best quality and how they apply it in every situation they find themselves.
Talking about how to remember, you know, how to be remembered. I know you still have many years ahead of you. People know you as RMD, you know, known as Richard Moffett, right? RMD, Major RMD Boom, you know, for those who know, they know, right? And like I said, I know you still have many years ahead of you, but as RMD, the man, RMD, the actor, RMD, the father, RMD, the husband, RMD, the lawyer, perhaps the business person, if you were to now say, sit down and say, okay, let me encapsulate all of this, right? And say, how would I want to be remembered? Or when people hear R&D, what should be the one thing that comes to mind? What would you say?
I don't want to worry about that in the sense, you know, for me, I want to be remembered as a man that had strong values for life, right? I believe that I will always be remembered as an actor. But as an actor with a conscience. That's all, with a conscience, not the actor who made so much money or had so much fame and squandered it and died of an overdose. No. It's an actor with a conscience, an active conscience that wanted the best for society and for his family and all that. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Sorry, I took your time.
No, this was different.